Mr. President, I'd like to test out how this will work, seated as we are. Would you say something, please, Mr. President?
Yes, I'm sincerely hopeful that when we get through talking about these presents, we'll know more about them than we do now.
Dave?
Well, I'm willing to be instructed.
Well, let's hold on. I'll play that back, see how it sounds. Mr. President, who were the first cabinet members of the President Washington's administration?
Washington appointed Thomas Jefferson, Secretary of State, and Alexander Hamilton, Secretary of the Treasury. And then he later appointed an Attorney General, Edmund Randolph, and he appointed a Secretary of War, Henry Knox. And he only had four members of his cabinet, but they were four truly great men. Every single one of them was a man of reputation and highly regarded by the people in the colonies. And I think the reason for their appointment was some of the acts that they carried out under the Continental Congress. Jefferson was a foreign representative of the Continental Congress and was familiar with the European situation. Alexander Hamilton was a financier and a great lawyer in the state of New York. And that same thing can be said of Edmund Randolph, who's the Attorney General. Henry Knox, of course, is one of Washington's generals. Washington knew that he was capable and able to run the War Department of the country. That's what they called it at that time, Secretary of War. Hamilton ran the whole War Department, which consisted of the Army and the Navy. And of course, he didn't have any Air Force at that time.
Mr. President, I note here that Washington, on important issues, asked for opinions from Hamilton and Jefferson because their invariable tendency to reach opposite conclusions provided Washington with a brilliant analysis of both sides of vital questions.
That's correct. That's correct. He's the only man, and I think the only president in the history, who had a cabinet that was made up of all shades of opinion. And he listened to all shades of opinion, and he made the decisions himself.
Well, just one more question then. Washington was said to be sympathetic to Hamilton's general economic and political philosophy and usually acted in accord with his advice.
I think that he was, of course, favorable to Hamilton because Washington was the richest man in the colonies at the time of the freedom of the colonies from Britain. And he naturally would lean in that direction. Hamilton, of course, came from the Antilles and didn't know who his father was. But that didn't keep him from being a great man and a great citizen of the United States. Jefferson, of course, was an aristocrat, just like Washington, a big landowner in Virginia. And Jefferson's ideas were arranged in such a way that he was always on the side of the fellow who had no representation, that is, the little people. Jefferson was always looking after their welfare and benefit. And there was a theory in effect in that time, no matter how much we may read the Declaration of Independence and say that all men are born free and equal, that most of the people in the colonies didn't believe it. They thought there was a class that was above all the rest of them, and Jefferson didn't. That was the difference between Jefferson and Hamilton.
Well, I note that Jefferson opposed Hamilton's recommendation of a national bank. He said that the creation would be unconstitutional since the power to charter a bank or a corporation had not been delegated by the state to the federal government. But Hamilton said that the doctrine of implied powers was emphasized. It was emphasized in a letter by Hamilton to Washington in which he asserted that the Constitution delegated specific powers and implied powers and that the implied powers were necessary to carry into effect the specific powers.
That's true, and that's been in effect ever since. Jefferson himself had to use those implied powers when he bought Louisiana.
Well, now, what was the reason for wanting a federal bank, a national bank at that time?
They were working out a financial system based on the system of Great Britain, the Bank of England, and the Bank of France, who issued banks, that is, they issued the money, and they made the credit of the federal government, offered the credit to the federal government, which it needed. Of course, at later dates, it decided that the financial policy of the United States should be in the hands of the Secretary of the Treasury under the President. And it's been that way ever since, except when it's delegated by some president who doesn't want to do it.
Well, to go back a little bit to the complexion of the Washington cabinet, were these appointments made on the basis of the known abilities of each one of the cabinet members, or were they political appointments?
They were made on the basis of the known abilities of the men, the known abilities of the men that were appointed.
Every one of them.
And their experience, and that's the reason he appointed them.
Of course, all the members were at first regarded as Federalists before there was any.
They were regarded as men who believed in a democratic republic. That is, a republic with a reign on the various powers. That's the reason they had three branches of the government, so that no one branch of the government could have the power concentrated. And all these men that Washington appointed were in favor of that start of a government, and they were called Democratic Republicans. And then, of course, the term Federalist was attached to those people as the people who believed in a federal government of the 13 colonies. That's how it came about. And eventually, the differences between those who believed in special privilege and those who believed in the welfare of the whole country, of the country as a whole, the little people as well as the great ones who were rich, caused the two-party system to be organized under Jefferson. And that Jefferson Party was called the Democratic Republican Party. And the other party, who believed in the centralization and financial control of the country, was the Federalist Party.
Was Washington's cabinet made up of all Federalists, or wasn't Jefferson a Democratic Republican right from the beginning?
I think he was, and he didn't know that, but that's eventually what came about when he organized the party of that name.
He was regarded as a Federalist.
They were all Federalists. They were all Federalists that were in favor of a republic, of a government that had that had these checks and balances and had restraints so that the mob couldn't rule government. That is the reason for the setup as it is now. It's worked perfectly for at least 180 years or something like that, close to it.
Well, could you define how the functions of each one of those cabinet members in brief? What was the responsibility and how were they related to the president?
Well, the responsibility, of course, was the Secretary of State was to establish relations with foreign nations. The foreign policy was to be established at that time under Washington's direction, and Jefferson was the best qualified man at the time to do that. Hamilton was familiar with the finances. He helped to finance the Revolutionary War, and he had served in it, as a colonel under General Washington. And he was interested in the control of the finances in such a way as to make the federal government a solvent and going concern, as anybody else would be in a business matter. Of course, the Attorney General was an interpreter of the Constitution for the benefit of the President of the United States.
Well, Mr. President, why was the Secretary of State, who was supposed to deal with foreign affairs, called Secretary of State? Didn't he have other duties as well, to seal, put the seal on papers and keep those?
He was the secretary to the government. That's what Secretary of State means. And, of course, he had a great seal of the United States under his control because he was the secretary to the government of the United States. And his position as secretary to the government of the United States automatically put him in control of the foreign policy of the United States as the president wanted it.
And it still exists. He still functions as the chief secretary of the government and with the great seal.
That's right, secretary of the government. And is the man who keeps the historical records of the government.
That hasn't changed at all right now.
No, it hasn't changed at all.
Because it's a very unusual dual office there in a way.
Well, yes, but every country has it. Every country has it. Now they have a half a dozen secretaries of state in Great Britain. They have a secretary of state for foreign affairs and secretary of state for domestic affairs. Each one of them is a secretary to the state in the line in which he's supposed to work. That's our secretary of state covers them all.
accepting that our Secretary of State is not necessarily a Secretary of a superpower state or a state that runs the country. This is...
attorney for the United States and enforce the laws that were passed by the Congress.
And Secretary of the Treasury, that his job was to look after the finances
of the government. That was his business entirely, to look after the finances of the government.
Well, the central bank then was definitely chartered for a period of 20 years in 1791.
That's correct.
And then they established a mint in 1792, also on the recommendation of Hamilton.
That's right, the coin money.
Well, were there private bankers in those days who pretty well decided the money policies of the nation?
Yes, and the private bankers in those days could issue script which circulated as money, usually at a discount. What Hamilton was trying to do was to get a circulating medium with the backing of the government that would never be discounted. It would be the standard on which the finances of the whole country were based.
Now, when did we establish an American monetary system? Was it right during that same period?
It worked out during that same period, and finally the Bank of the United States, which was the United States Central Bank, got so powerful that they tried to tell the President what to do and how to finance things. When the financing of the executive branch of the government comes from the Congress, and that's when Jackson refused to allow the Bank of the United States to be rechartered and established the Treasury Department of the United States as the financial center of the country.
The thing lapsed, though, shortly thereafter to where the money control went out of the government of the United States into private sources.
It went into the United States Bank, and that's what Jackson didn't like.
So it was really not the United States Bank. It was called the United States, but it was not the Bank of the United States.
No, it was the United States Bank. It's not called the Bank of the United States.
Like the Bank of America today is not the Bank of America.
That's right. Not like the Bank of England or the Bank of France, either one, which are the Bank of England and the Bank of France are the treasury departments of those two governments.
Government control.
That's right.
This is tape number one, the end of tape number one of September 14th, the morning. The President, Noyes Hillman, present. President Noyes Hillman here. All right, Dave, you were going to ask the President.
Well, I was going to ask you about the setting up and the designing of the White House during Washington's administration. He never occupied the White House.
No, he did not occupy the White House, but he laid the cornerstone of the White House. And when we rehabilitated the White House, we tried to find that cornerstone and never did succeed in finding it. I don't know what happened to it.
Well, what was the who inspired the design and the architecture and the general facility of the White House?
I think the architect's name was Holbein, if I'm not mistaken. He also designed the Capitol.
Yeah, but did George Washington take part in that?
Oh, yes.
Martha Washington?
They were consulted, of course, but they never lived in it. The first time the White House, the end of the Adams administration, I think.
That's right.
In 1798 or something. I think they moved in there before
1801.
The House. 1801. Well, maybe it was. But they moved in before the House was finished. The Adamses did, and the correspondence and diary of Mrs. Adams is most interesting about the inconveniences of the new house. The President's House was the proper name of it.
It just got plastered, but they didn't even have stairs to the upstairs and so on.
And they used the East Room to hang the wet wash in.
That's right.
Mr. President, why was Washington's first residence in New York, and why did it then shift to Philadelphia?
Well, opinion was that New York was located in such a way that the New Englanders and those from the South could reach it as conveniently as any other place. And then, since the Continental Congress had been meeting in Philadelphia all the time, it was decided that they would move the capital to Philadelphia because the legislators, most of whom were in the Congress of the United States and had been in the Continental Congress, were familiar with Philadelphia and liked the place. That's the principal reason they did that. And then Maryland and Virginia decided to give a section of land, 10 miles square, part in Virginia and part in Maryland, on which to establish a capital of the United States and to be known as the Federal District, which would contain only the capital and transact the capital's business, so that they couldn't have riots and things of the kind like they've been having in London and in Paris previous to that time.
Do you recall whether it was in Philadelphia where Washington was called by the Senate to discuss a treaty matter which ended all discussion or appearance by the President?
This was a voluntary approach by the President. He believed in advice and concern in the Constitution, and he went down to get advice on this treaty that he was working on. And they were so discourteous to him, they told him that they couldn't legislate that way. They'd have to send this matter to a committee, and anyway, they couldn't work with the President of the United States sitting there, and the old man left in the huff. In fact, he gave him a good cussing and then pulled out.
Where was that? Philadelphia?
In Philadelphia. It had to be in Philadelphia.
Well, now, the whole administration setup involved no struggle as between the wealthy citizens of the United States and the so-called unendowed people.
No, it didn't. It didn't at that time. But when the land settlement of the Northwest Territories was taking place, and when the Georgia and ceded their claim to Alabama and Mississippi and opened them to settlement, and Tennessee decided to make a state of themselves, and Tennessee was a part of North Carolina, then the struggle began between the people who were trying to get a start in life and to settle and clear these lands as a title to their of their own. Then's when the difficulty originated between the controllers of the money power in the United States. It's just been just like it is now. The bankers and the great rich men were in control of the finances. Then it was that Jefferson came to the top with his saying that the people who were trying to make these settlements should have a chance to make these settlements, have land conditions of their own under which they could operate. And they made Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Wisconsin, and Michigan out of the Northwest Territory. Tennessee, they came, got loose from North Carolina, and Vermont from New York under these same conditions. And so the thing has been going on ever since in that same sort of a way. And usually there's the pendulum swings one side of the clock to the other. Conservatives control the country part of the time, and the so-called liberals, most of whom are not liberals, control the country the other part of the time.
And yet you would not call the Washington administration as a completely conservative administration, would you?
It was more conservative than anything else. It had to be to start the situation off. I think conservative is as possible for a man to be, and as natural that he should be. But nobody but Washington could have set up the government, because he's the only man that could make decisions and make them stick, and even at that, they attacked him. Oh, he was treated like a pickpocket. Oh, he was treated like a pickpocket while he was president. Pickpocket while he was president.
By whom did he say? Now, well, for what reason?
Because he enforced the laws of the country, particularly when he put out a whiskey rebellion. The whiskey makers didn't want to pay the tax on the whiskey. He made them pay it. And they had the same troubles up in New England. New England threatened to secede during Washington's administration, but they didn't.
Well, in other words, he did not go along with the privileged who wanted to avoid their responsibilities.
He was responsible as President of the United States for a foreign policy that was the proper thing at that time. That's where isolationism originated, in the last letter of Washington to the Congress, called Washington's last farewell address. And then, in addition to that, he cemented the colonies into a country. And when they adopted the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, that took the made certain checks and balances on the government of the United States for the protection of the individual. That's what the first 10 amendments are on there for. And Jefferson was responsible for them.
Well, the question always arises, what inspired the colonies to go through the extreme action of war and revolution, or revolution and war, if there were not a general welfare situation in there, a situation involved among the people?
Taxation without representation, that's what brought the Revolutionary War on. The sinking of the T-ship in Boston Harbor.
But it was not taxation on the masses of people.
Everybody drank tea.
Well, they were not aware of any direct taxation. It had to be dramatized.
Well, it was. It was dramatized by the sinking of the tea in Boston Harbor at that time. But then the colonies had found that there was no way for 13 small states to deal with the world at large. And there was no way for 13 states with 13 commercial ideas to trade even with themselves until the fence around the border. So you find in the Constitution the Commerce Clause, which prevents any state from levying a fee on the people of any other state who want to do business in that state. That cemented the country together. We got to work it.
Well, I just want to establish the background here for this drafting of the Constitution, which was born at a time when the control of the government and the general administration of the government was in conservative hands, and yet the Constitution itself seemed to have had elements in it that provided for a gradual liberalization of the country.
There's no question about that. And their experience as dealing through the Continental Congress, which had no powers of enforcement, as the cause of the creation of the Constitution that did have powers of enforcement. That's the reason we have an executive to enforce the laws. Didn't have any in the Continental Congress.
Now, he didn't undertake any liberal, the government didn't undertake any liberal interpretation of the Constitution until it was Jefferson's time, isn't it?
Yes. There were two ideas of the situation. One was the concentration of powers in the federal government, and one was the idea that certain powers that had not been delegated by the states could not be used by anything but the states.
That's the Hamilton versus Jefferson theory. You had a point there.
Well, the point is that the Republican Democratic Party emerges from a consolidation of opponents of the Federalist policies and theories, and it states that the Federalist Party principles included control of government by the upper classes was essential to the welfare of masses who were declared incapable of directing the government.
That's correct.
And Jefferson, with James Madison as his chief lieutenant, opposed the Federalist doctrines as harsh, reactionary, and contradictory to the American spirit of liberalism and democracy. That's where it gets specifically, and where they specifically attacked the Hamiltonian program of funding the debt, assumption of state debt, excise tax, national bank, and advocacy of higher tariffs. They denounced these as an instrument for the exploitation of farmers and laborers by the wealthy. That's now the
point. I wanted to get to the...
That's just what it was.
That's interesting, because I wanted to get the president's view on how this Constitution, born during this kind of a period, could have in it those elements of enormous flexibility that seem to have been built into things by the very same people who, when they were in power, were very tough and reactionary.
Remember this, that every sentence in the Constitution was debated, no end. And the records of those debates are in James Madison's book, The Federalist, which shows you that every section of the Constitution was debated by the people who afterwards became the powers to enforce it. And the views of every section of the 13 colonies was taken into consideration. And when the Constitution came out, it came out as, I think, the greatest document of government that's ever been written by man. Very few countries have a constitution, except those that have come after the Constitution of the United States was adopted. And a lot of times they don't even pay any attention to the Constitution when they have one. We do. And the reason for that Constitution standing up is because it was made up in such a way that the administrations which had control of the government could interpret it for the benefit and welfare of all the people and not just a few, although the time has come, time and again, when the same few that wanted to control the country as a whole and didn't believe that part of the population had sense enough to have any hand in the government are still trying to get into control. There's still plenty of them left. Just as many Federalists in the country now as there were in colonial times. Only there's many more of the other brand of people if they don't have any chance to control the government for very long.
Well, then you define the Constitution as not only a great document, but a highly evolutionary document.
That's right. Not only highly evolutionary, it's a revolutionary document, if you want to put it straight.
Why? Why revolutionary?
Because it does something that no other government in the history of the world had done up to that time. It's a government set out in the preamble to the Constitution, which is a part of the Constitution. It took the Supreme Court a long time to find it, but it's there. If you read the preamble to that Constitution, you'll see what it provides and why it's a document that is flexible enough to make the country run no matter whether the population is 3 million or whether it's 180 million.
In other words, this written document, in a way, is more flexible than all the so-called unwritten documents or unwritten Constitution of England.
That's correct. That's absolutely correct. And it's interpretation of the Constitution as it has gone along over the period of the time that it's been in effect since 1789, that makes it a great document. Still works just as well as it did when it was first adopted. Of course, it's been amended a number of times, and those amendments, nearly every one of them, have made a contribution except the Prohibition Amendment and the limitation on the office holding of the President. Those two were bad amendments. Someday they'll repeal the 22nd Amendment.
Well, do you feel then that it had in mind that self-government was a very difficult thing to achieve, and that as people grew more with the experience of self-government, they would have more opportunities for participation in many other things, and that the Constitution would gradually unfold into a major liberal document, which it had room for, but didn't quite apply at the time it was being put into effect?
It had to be worked out by experience. And the very fact that it was drawn in such a way that it could be improved and interpreted by experience is the reason for its lasting quality.
This is the end of take number 2 of the morning of September 14th.